stations, or advertisers.
Stand back here at Radio Liberty, coming from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, and, well, this next hour, they're going to be the views of Dr. Carson Holloway. We've had Dr. Holloway on before. He's a political scientist, associate professor of political science, I believe, at the University of Nebraska. Is that Nebraska?
Yes, Nebraska at Omaha.
Okay, fine.
And, Lincoln.
And, of course, we've had him on with his other book, All Shook Up, talking about what's happening, the impact of music, modern-day music, rock music on our society. And then, of course, his latest book, The Right Darwin, Evolution, Religion, and the Future of Democracy. And it's a fascinating treatise because it goes into the background of Darwinism and the fact that some of the Darwinists say, oh, well, we don't need religion for morality. We can have morality without religion because people are just sort of naturally moral. We've evolved into being more moral. And how anybody could really believe that, I really don't know. And yet these people are very erudite. They're very well-educated. They are the leaders philosophically of the Darwinian movement. And yet they say, oh, my goodness, we can have a moral society. We don't need outmoded religion. And Dr. Holloway certainly refutes that in his excellent book. Would you like to give our listeners a little the background of this debate that's going on today within the Darwinian school?
Sure, I'd like to do that. The book is kind of a refutation of what I call in the book Darwinian, or what one of the authors I critique in the book calls Darwinian conservatism, or an effort to create a Darwinian natural right teaching, or, as you say, a morality based upon Darwinism. And that's been an interesting and much-noticed movement in political science over the last 20 or 30 years among political theorists, but also among some conservative intellectuals, too. And, in fact, there's some overlap. Some of the political scientists that I talk about in the book are rather well-known conservatives, like James Q. Wilson and Francis Fukuyama, and Larry Arnhart is another one. And I think what they're doing is, in a way, understandable, and even motivated by good intentions. They've seen the problems that are caused by moral relativism, and so they're trying to show that since, you know, biological science still has some credibility with people on the left and people who are inclined to moral relativism, if we could show that there are moral principles rooted in our biological nature, then maybe we'd be doing a good thing in shoring up morality. But then, as understandable it is to try to do that, I try to show in the book that this is a failed project and that this effort to, you know, the part of this is an effort to replace a religious-based morality with a purely naturalistic morality. And I argue, drawing on my own critique of them as well as on Alexis de Tocqueville, that that project fails.
And, of course, you never had to teach a child how to be bad. I mean, children are bad automatically. You've got to teach them how to be good. And, you know, can you depend upon the morality of a 15-year-old if you tell him that he's going to make the decisions? I mean, this is an age-old argument of whether we can make the intelligent decisions on our own, or we need to have, well, we need to have God to lay out certain laws and restrictions for us. But it's a philosophical debate, and yet it gets right back to the thing, do we need God? Can man exist without God? And I don't think he can, do you?
I do not, and ultimately that's what the book concludes, that we can't really have a solid morality without the principles that we get from revealed religion. Yeah.
And of course, the trouble is that these scientists, I hate to say it, but I think many of them are educated far beyond their intelligence. I know because I used to believe all of these things. We'll be right back in just a moment. Well, our guest is Carson Holloway, Dr. Carson Holloway, associate professor there at the University of Nebraska. And Chris, now how are evolutionary biology and conservative thought traditionally at odds with one another? Why this evolutionary biology? They believe that, of course, we've evolved into not only a higher form of life, but into a higher form of morality. But is that really true? Are we becoming a more moral people because, of course, we've evolved into a moral people?
Well, yeah, what I try to show in the book is that, or at least I note at the beginning, that there is a kind of traditional antagonism between conservatism and Darwinism going back to the 19th century, because people saw that Darwinism tended to look like it was hostile to religious faith, and a lot of popularizers of Darwinism were hostile to religious faith, and conservatives thought that religion was essential to a healthy society. And what these newer Darwinists contend is that, as you were suggesting, we can give a perfectly adequate account of morality simply based on natural biological impulses of human beings, and so we don't really need to set up this contrast between conservatism and Darwinism anymore, but at the same time, then we don't really need religion. And their argument is that we have evolved certain natural impulses to be moral, like at the most rudimentary level, there's probably a biological basis for mothers taking care of their children and fathers taking care of the mothers of their children, and a natural basis for, reciprocal justice and keeping contracts with other people. And I don't have a big problem with that as far as that goes. I think there's decent evidence for that. But what I point out in the book is that, as even the Darwinians admit, there are natural bases for behaviors that you could only regard as immoral, like exploitation and slavery and other things of that character. And because they try to confine their moral teaching to the purely naturalistic sphere, or just the realm of natural passions or instincts, they really can't prioritize among those instincts or create a hierarchy of them that would allow you to have a kind of solid morality that would tell you when to prefer the moral passions over the immoral ones. That's exactly what revealed religion provides, though, right? The biblical teaching gives us a kind of, playbook whereby we can tell which of our impulses are moral and which ones aren't and which ones are to be preferred.
Well, I really think, of course, all we have to do is look at society today. Mm-hmm. And 60 million Americans have a sexually transmitted viral disease. Half of our marriages end in divorce. Certainly, as far as the black community, I think 75% of children are raised in a family without a father. In the white community, probably 25-30%. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Dr. Carson Holloway. We're talking about a recent book he's written called The Right Darwin. Of course, we've talked to him before on his other previously written book, All Shook Up, about music. Fascinating book. But this book is entirely different. It's a philosophical discourse between himself and many of the Darwinists who consider themselves conservatives. And, of course, they figure that we don't need a God to have a moral society, because Darwinism has evolved to certainly basic conservative principles, because these things work better, and since they naturally work better, then we don't need to go to the archaic religions. And of course, so I don't think that Dr. Holloway agrees with that at all. Now, does Darwinism support in any way conservative values? How can they possibly say that Darwinism, supports conservative values, when everything I think about, associated with my years as being a Darwinist, was mm-hmm. actually liberal, everything, suddenly there was no need for a God, there was no need for moral values, and because, of course, Darwinism explained everything, and, of course, Darwinism basically attacks the basic concept that there is a God, mm-hmm. Everything happened by accident. We don't need a creator that way. We don't need anything other than science.
Yeah, I think they make an argument that Darwinism supports conservative values, and I can see that, but I would say only equivocally. Darwinism, what it teaches us about human nature, doesn't really provide much support for anything in particular because of the diversity of the human passions that we seem to have based on our biological nature. Let me try to give one example. They would argue that there's a natural biological basis for the natural family, understood as man and woman and their biological offspring. Well, that's true. And to the extent that they point that out and therefore warn kind of leftist social reconstructivists that they shouldn't try to mess with the natural family or else there'll be consequences, that's fine. But what they leave out is, or what they admit implicitly but then don't draw out the consequences from, would be the following. Their theory also shows that an observation of man's biological nature would show that there's a natural biological basis for male promiscuity. The problem, what religion provides is that it can provide an account of your duties as a man to remain faithful to your family that doesn't need to have recourse to your desires. In fact, that morality would tell you there's some of your desires or passions that are unruly, that need to be kept in check. Darwinism really can't tell you that. In fact, these Darwinian conservatives frankly admit in many cases that Darwinism would tell you to follow your strongest passions. And ultimately, that is kind of a recipe for social chaos. And that's one of the reasons I find that morality lacking in the book.
Well, why should we be wary of basing conservative values on evolutionary biology? It seems to me that there's no way that you could actually base a conservative belief on evolutionary biology, and yet these people are advocating that.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, and what I try to show in some of the chapters of the book is that Darwinism really can't sustain, for example, universal morality of respect for the rights and dignity of a human being as a human being, because Darwinists admit that human beings are by nature tribal and committed to their own kind of clan or circle, and that they easily dehumanize outsiders. And again, if you're going to say that we have biological propensity to those things, which is probably true, but then if you're also going to add, as these Darwinians do, that we can't get our values from anything other than our biological propensities, you really won't be able to resist those things. Whereas, again, biblical religion provides an account for the dignity of the human person, the idea that all are created in the image and likeness of God. But then, as you suggest, ultimately, it's not just universal morality, but any morality cannot be sustained on the basis of Darwinism because of the presence of, again, non-moral or even immoral psychological passions that are no doubt natural, but that are not really respectable or again, ethical. And the Darwinists, because they want to say that basically the good is what is desirable, what we subjectively experience as desirable, can't give an account of why we should try to hold in check these less than moral passions. And I think that's where their morality falls apart.
I'm sure it does. And you know, but I don't even understand why they want to argue these things, because they're so illogical. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't believe that you can have morality without some sort of adherence to a religion.
Yeah. I think that they probably, either they don't have the faith anymore, or they just don't think that it's going to be resuscitated in our culture. You know, they no longer believe that religion's going to be able to convince that many people. And so they want to try this alternative. My argument would be that, A, their alternative doesn't work that well, and so we shouldn't go down that path. But B, since even Darwinians seem to admit that human beings have a natural inclination toward even religion, then we should always give the religious explanation a chance. I think there's always the opportunity that religious arguments and faith-based arguments will resonate with people precisely because man is naturally a religious being.
But of course, most of these philosophers, most of these Darwinian philosophers, are actively anti-religion. Mm-hmm. I simply, some people, some Christians, can actually accept Darwinism, look upon a sort of a guided evolution.
Uh-huh.
But you will never find a Darwinist who would come, and concede anything at all, because, of course, they're actively anti-religious. They're anti-God.
Yeah, no, that's true of some of them. Certainly, some people I don't deal with at length, but mention Richard Dawkins is a Darwinian who's obviously very hostile to religion, and even irrationally so. You know, you mentioned earlier that some scientists seem to be educated beyond their intelligence. They're definitely often sort of speaking beyond their competence, too. They make, like Dawkins, philosophic arguments about atheism or the existence of God and act as if they're somehow arguing from their science, when in fact it's clear that they're not, and that science can't prove or disprove God's existence one way or the other. The fact that somebody like Dawkins will act as if it could doesn't speak well for his philosophic sophistication. But yeah, I think you're right. In addition to everything else, there does seem to be a kind of, I use a term I heard from somebody recently that's pretty good, deophobia, right? Fear of God. They don't want it. They don't want to believe in God, and so they're trying to build up as much as they can this alternative explanation, which in the end really can't meet the needs of us as human beings.
Amen to that. In fact, there's one scene in the movie on Ulysses, and you know, I remember the story of Ulysses, and he'd gone to Troy, and then he wanted to go home to his family, and instead of that, he keeps getting diverted all over the world, as it were, and goes from one adventure to another. And one time he stands on the beach and he shouts to the waves, why are you doing this to me? And this voice comes back and says, because man cannot live without his gods. And you know, to me that was such a very profound statement, even though it wasn't necessarily a religious story at all. Mm-hmm. But of course I believe that man needs to have this this being to whom he's answerable, because why, of course, you end up with moral anarchy, which is what we have today. Now, you make a point. Is there a moral order in this concept of natural selection that the Darwinians talk about?
Yeah, that's a very interesting question to me. Yes, the answer is no and yes, I guess. For them, for those who promote this Darwinian morality, they admit that natural selection is itself an amoral process. And they'll admit that it's not guided, that it doesn't seek any particular end. It just sort of develops by happenstance and necessity. But their argument happens to be that through this chance and deterministic process, or this combination of chance and necessity, we have gotten a nature, a human nature that is moral in some ways. Again, the things I mentioned earlier, like the disposition to engage in reciprocal trade with other people, or to bond with your community and make sacrifices for your community. These look like moral propensities, and they have a biological basis that came about through evolution. In the end, though, I think this points to another weakness in their teaching, which is that by their own admission, these moral dispositions we find in ourselves are merely the product of chance and necessity. They don't link up to any bigger order in the cosmos or any kind of universal hierarchy of goods. And that, I think, tends to undermine their compelling qualities in us. You know, if you have a sense, as a religious person would, that there are cosmic things at stake and whether or not you do your duty, that's one kind of motivation to be moral. If you believe, as a Darwinian must, that this feeling that you have to do your duty is just sort of an accidental byproduct of evolution, that's not as good an inducement to do the moral thing.
Well, of course, part of your book, you deal, in fact, throughout much of your book, you deal with de Tocqueville. Now, I think most people don't know who de Tocqueville was. So who was de Tocqueville, and why is he important? Why is this Frenchman important to understanding not only America as it existed in the mid-1800s, but, of course, this debate that is going on today?
Yeah. I think de Tocqueville is very important to understanding our needs as a democratic people. He was a French political philosopher who traveled to America in the 19th century and ended up writing this enormous and enormously important book, Democracy in America. And he makes many points in that book about the needs of democracy and the way that prudent and responsible statesmen and leaders would try to lead democracy. One of his key arguments is that democracy will end up, in the long run, having inclinations or propensities that are threatening to human dignity and human freedom, and that religion is the antidote to those tendencies. He's very insistent that we need a religiously based morality in order to make democracy livable and decent. And that's really what's challenged by these Darwinians today, and part of the book's project is to show that Tocqueville's analysis is still vital and, in fact, to be preferred, I think.
And I think as a nation turns against God, why, of course, I think eventually why God turns against that nation, and that nation goes on into disarray. And we see this sort of in the stories of the Bible time and time again in the Old Testament, where the children of Israel turned against God, and of course we know what happened to the northern tribes and the southern tribes, and time and again, of course, they were defeated and destroyed and carried off by their enemies. We'll be back in just a moment. Well, of course, these are the important issues of our time, and tragically, we have an educational system where no mention at all of God is allowed by the Supreme Court, where they can teach Darwinism, but they can't mention anything about Christianity. Certainly, we can have condoms in school, but we can't have Bibles in school, and we can't have the Ten Commandments posted on the wall, because the Supreme Court has held that if we had the Ten Commandments, they wouldn't do any good unless the children read them. And if the children read them, they would have to meditate upon them. And if they meditated upon them, why, they might obey them. And that would be a violation of the wall of separation between church and state. And then we wonder why we have 60 million Americans with a sexually transmitted viral disease, the end result of a society based upon Darwinism and the destruction of Christianity. How do they answer the moral chaos that really is existing throughout our society today, the breakdown of the family, the breakdown of morality, the breakdown of public health? I mean, what do the Darwinists say to that? Do they accept any responsibility for it?
Well, not really, and in fact, they tend to argue, to the extent that they address those questions, that those things will just work themselves out. That's the argument of Francis Fukuyama's book, The Great Disruption. He's one of the people I deal with. He's a very famous figure. And he admits and goes into great detail and is obviously very familiar with the statistics that show the terrible disruptions of morality and family life that have taken place over the last 40 years in Western industrialized nations. But he argues that there will be a, to use his terms, spontaneous renorming, or just a kind of automatic return to morality, because, again, on his Darwinian view, morality is adequately based in biological human nature. And one of the arguments I make in the book against him is that, to whatever extent that might be true, he makes it look more true because the morality that, and this is a general problem with Darwinian morality, the morality that they're arguing for is not really all that demanding or all that high. Darwinism, to the extent that it can make a claim to supporting morality, seems like it can support a morality of sort of minimal decency. But not really a higher morality or a morality of, high ethical virtue that demands self-sacrifice. And that's another argument against it as far as I'm concerned. I think most human beings see that in some cases we're called to very noble, heroic virtue, and Darwinism doesn't really have much support for heroism. After all, it's all about, in the end, survival and perpetuating your offspring, and heroism sometimes, very often in fact, doesn't really conduce to those ends.
Well, I wonder why these Darwinists are really trying to say that Darwinism can lead to morality. Do they have a guilty conscience? Mm-hmm. Are they trying to neutralize us? After all, maybe we could just sit down and talk to these nice Darwinists, and we have nothing in common with them, because, of course, unfortunately, they've embraced a philosophy that is, in effect, destroying the very foundation of our nation. Why are they trying to become acceptable to the Christian population?
Again, I don't know if they're trying to be acceptable to the Christian population. I think they're trying to make morality acceptable to the kind of liberal post-Christian population. I think they figure that the only way to reach those people is through a kind of what looks like a scientific argument that bows to Darwinism. I think they figure those people are never going to be convinced by any appeal to faith, and that they'll never take intelligent design or something like that seriously.
Hold that thought. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and of course, Darwinism is the official religion of the United States. People don't understand that, but certainly we can teach Darwinism in our schools all across America. But in none of our schools can we teach Christianity or the divinity of Jesus Christ, or, that we can teach maybe the Bible as history, something of that sort. But you're not allowed to post the Ten Commandments in our classrooms. The federal Supreme Court has said that. We can't mention God in our classes. We can't have prayer in our classes. And yet the Supreme Court opens its sessions every day there in the Supreme Court building when the choir comes in and says, God save the United States and this honorable court. And yet, we can't mention God in our classrooms. I mean, this is obviously an evolution of an idea. It is basically an effort to destroy the religious faith of our children. They've done such a good job of that. That's what's really so frightening. And then Darwin is coming along and trying to tell us that Darwinism can lead to morality, that we are evolving into a moral people because of this natural process of evolution. I think it's the most ridiculous thing I ever heard.
Well, you know, somebody asked me once why I wanted to work on this book, and the basic answer I ended up giving them was because I don't think a Darwinian conservatism can conserve anything that I really think is valuable. And that's basically the argument against it, that it purports to sustain morality, but the morality that it claims to sustain on close examination turns out to be not much of a morality. And then on closer examination yet, it turns out that it can't sustain even that morality. And, you know, it's, again, I think the people, let's take them at face value. I think they're well-intentioned. But it's a failed project, and I think we would do better to turn our attention to ways to revitalize faith in biblical revelation as a basis for a healthy society rather than arguments based on Darwinian biology.
But, of course, this is not happening in our society today, and even many of our churches are more interested in growth and entertainment than they are in getting back to those fundamental principles of the Bible that once were, of course, strongly adhered to by our people.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly there's no more fear of God out there. There's we've changed the message of the Bible. We've changed the music of our churches, and of course, I think America, as long as it continues on its present course, is going to continue on the way down. There's no way a society can exist after it's turned its back on God, and yet this is actually what these Darwinists want. They really, you know, and you read what they say, they want to destroy faith in God because they hate God, it would almost appear. They think that how could any intelligent person believe in a God?
Yeah, well, that's the remark made by, again, Richard Dawkins, and that's a remark that tells you more about him than anybody that he's talking about, I think. It's obvious from anybody who's even passingly familiar with the history of human thought that there have been plenty of very intelligent people who believed in God, even though Dawkins has managed to avoid meeting any. But there again, I think, at least in his case, and the more strident people who are among his followers, that shows a certain, really, a kind of non-scientific ability to come to grips with reality. The fact is that the attraction of many very intelligent people to belief in revelation from God shows that there's something in human nature that responds to that, and it's not just some insanity or, you know, weird irrational quirk that the uneducated have. And I, you know, generally all these books from the last couple of years that attack belief in God and, you know, try to make the case for atheism, I think they all suffer from that defect. They don't really make an effort to understand what they're criticizing.
And, of course, the thing is that as science develops more knowledge of the DNA code, and increasingly there is this move towards intelligent design. And I think that a lot of thinking scientists actually today, even some of the people who've been lifelong atheists, are beginning to look and see what we're learning about the very makeup of life and coming to realize there has to be a creator. They may not accept, you know, Christianity. They may not even accept the concepts of the Bible or of the traditional God, but they realize there has to be a creator out there. There has to be some intelligence that has created this marvelous, you know, life, this process of life. And do you think this is really growing within the scientific community?
Well, I don't know that much about intelligent design. My book more makes the argument from our experience of morality than our experience of the order of the natural world. But, you know, you have to admit there are some respectable and intelligent people who are advancing that position, and I think they deserve to be engaged and argued with, you know, and listened to rather than dismissed, which seems to be the tactic of the really committed Darwinists.
In fact, in many universities, why, of course, they will go after and actively persecute those who do not embrace Darwinism. I saw it the other day where somebody, you know, did not get their tenure because they believed in creation rather than evolution. That doesn't speak very well for the scientific nature of so many of the Darwinists in our academia. We'll be right back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and of course, basically, what are the dangers of embracing Darwinism as the authoritative account of human nature? I mean, certainly, is it a dangerous thing to embrace these concepts put forward as an explanation for human nature? Because is there any real basis in science, or is this sort of wishful thinking on the part of the Darwinists that man evolves into a higher moral being?
Yeah, I think there are several dangers. A couple of them I've already alluded to. I don't think that Darwinism can provide a sound basis for universal morality or morality where we respect the rights of human beings because they're human beings, because Darwinism insists that man is by nature a tribal being more than a cosmopolitan being. He's more interested in his own group and its advancement rather than the rights of people as people. I don't think, as I indicated before, that Darwinism can sustain a very noble morality. It doesn't really call anybody to anything very high. And I also make the argument that, you know, biotechnology is a problem. And a lot of the Darwinians acknowledge this. And there are people who are doing work in biotechnology claim they're going to be able to redesign human nature and do all sorts of weird and radical things to us or themselves. And it seems to me that that's a project fraught with moral danger, and in the end, Darwinism does not provide any coherent or compelling account as to why we should not go down that path of reinventing ourselves through technology. It can't, because in the end, for a Darwinian, there's nothing really special or dignified about human nature or humanity. For the religious believer, what we are is somehow the intention of a wise and good creator. For a Darwinian, what we are, or our human nature, is ultimately the product of chance and necessity that aims at nothing in particular. And you can't say that human nature is better than any other nature. If that's the case, I don't see how there's a basis for respect for human dignity in the first place, but I also don't see how there's a basis for claiming that we ought to conserve our being as we've inherited it. And that's a very serious question for the future, and one where I think you embrace Darwinism, you're forced into kind of disarmament.
And of course, what about slavery? How do they feel about slavery?
I talk about that at length because, of course, being good, decent, modern people, they're all opposed to slavery. But one of the thinkers in question, in particular, rather, Larry Arnhart, tries to show that there's a Darwinian case against slavery. And I take that really as the test case. It seems to me that if your morality can't show the injustice of slavory,
hold that thought.
Hold that
thought.
Go ahead.
We'll be right back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and we were simply talking about slavery, and we'll get back to that in just a moment. But before we go on, I wanted to offer Dr. Holloway the opportunity to tell our listeners that if he has a website or how they can get hold of his book, Right Darwin.
Yeah, The Right Darwin and my other book, too, are available from Spence Publishing. People could go to www.spencepublishing.com or call their 800 number, which is 1-888-SPEN-PUB, if they're interested in acquiring the book.
All right, I'm amazed they've kept your book in print. That's the first one that is all shook up, because other books they've had, excellent books, they went out of print very shortly. And yours has been around for many years, then, hasn't it?
Well, yeah, and I'm pleased about that.
Yeah, but I think certainly they must think a great deal of it. I guess it must still be selling.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
yeah.
Our telephone number, if you're out there in the listening audience, is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. If you'd like to talk to our guest this evening, if you have any question for him, because he's done a great deal of thought on this. And we talked during the time we were off the air about this concept of slavery. Would you like to go into the background of that? Because here we have a group of intellectuals, Darwinists, and they're talking about how Darwinism leads to morality. And, of course, we naturally evolve into morality. Certainly, we evolve into a concept where men will take care of mm-hmm. women and take care of their children. And, well, you know, well, if that's really true, then why do half of our families break up, or why do half of our marriages end in divorce if we're evolving into something better? So let's go into the background. There's a gentleman named Mr. Arndt who has put forward these ideas. What is his thought, and how does he address this problem of slavery? And because is slavery right or wrong according to the Darwinist?
Yeah, Arnhart argues in his longest chapter in his book, which is entitled Darwinian Natural Right, and he has a more recent book too called Darwinian Conservatism. But he argues that you can make a Darwinian argument out against slavery. I think that's essential because, as I was saying before the break, if your morality can't demonstrate the wrongness of slavery, you've got a pretty poor morality. So I think it's important that he tries to do that. But I do think the argument fails. Basically, the Darwinian argument against slavery comes down to little more than we have a natural desire for freedom and a natural desire for just reciprocal relationships with others. And slavery violates those natural instincts so that slaves are frustrated, they're not happy, and masters feel guilty. Well, that all is, you know, possibly true, but nevertheless, they admit that we have natural desires for exploitation and easy gain and things of that nature. And as soon as you admit the naturalness of those impulses, you can start to make a case for slavery. It's just as natural as freedom is. And certainly if you look at human history, you'll see that slavery has existed and flourished for long periods of time in various civilizations. Not that it's just, right? It's unjust. But it certainly shows that if you're going to confine your analysis purely to the realm of nature, you'd probably look at the whole history of humanity and say, well, slavery looks kind of ambiguous. Some people practice it, but some people have abolished it. It's kind of hard to tell whether it's right or wrong. You really need some kind of more authoritative morality, again, which the very people who worked hardest to abolish slavery were animated by religious morality, not by some merely natural morality.
And, of course, the thing is that certainly as you look at the basic concepts of morality, I mean, what's wrong with killing if there is no God to be answerable to? I mean, you can say, well, of course, we shouldn't kill, but that is a moral judgment based upon God's law, not about anything that's mm-hmm. evolved throughout time. You look at the Nazis, I mean, there's a wonderful book we have, actually many, many quotations from the Nazis. And you know, Rudolf Hess had said that Nazism was simply applied science. Now, of course, the Darwinists claim that they're scientists searching for truth, but in the end, of course, if you're looking for the survival of the fittest, what was wrong with what the Jews did of doing away with the invalids and those mentally incapacitated people and the gypsies? And they looked upon the Jews as inferior. They were just trying to clean up the genetic pool and survival of the fittest, which is certainly the Darwinian concept. And how would these people look upon the Nazi movement, which was all science, mm-hmm. based upon science and based upon the Darwinian concept of the survival of the fittest, yeah. selective breeding?
Well, I think they would say that, you know, they would argue that this was a perversion of Darwinism, what the Nazis did. You know, and that's a very delicate question. I mean, Darwin himself was kind of a humanitarian in some ways. You know, he was an opponent of slavery. But on the other hand, you can find passages in his writings where he seems to talk about the inferiority of some races to others. So there would be things that unsavory types like the Nazis could grab onto in his work. I think also the Darwinians would say, though, and this is again where I would disagree with them, they would say that, you know, the Nazis and the communists, too, tried to make people live contrary to human nature by making them live in ways that were flagrantly immoral. But again, we see that they were able to succeed, at least for a while, in doing so, and that suggests that you know, if you're just going to confine yourself to the realm of nature, you're not going to have an adequate argument against them. If I were going to argue against the Nazis or the communists, I would rather be able to appeal to the transcendent dignity of every human being as created in God's image and not to some kind of watery notions of reciprocity or compassion that you get from Darwinism.
And, of course, how can you say that you know, what they did might not be, was immoral if you don't have a moral standard? And if you have a moral standard and you're a Darwinist, it has to be your standard, and you then take the place of God. Mm-hmm. Well, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's, pardon me, 1-888-24-LIBERTY. If you have a question or comment, we have Roger on the line. Roger, do you have a question or comment for our guest?
Yeah, thanks. I think it's interesting to hear somebody like Stephen Jay Gould spout this equalitarian claptrap. I think many of these people must be closet racial superior artists. If only, it would be logically required, wouldn't it? Because if you have little as 50, 100,000 years of differentiation among racial subtypes, then there would almost invariably have to be superiority rising out of one or more of these subtypes, wouldn't one think?
Well, you know, that's a good question. I'm not sure about the answer to that, but I see your point from another angle, though, which is that Gould and Dawkins and other guys like that do constantly spout kind of a modern, liberal, egalitarian line when it comes to morality and relationships among nations. You know, they tend to be, right there. Yet there's no support for that in their science or even in the Darwinian account of morality. I mean, there's nothing in Darwinism that would lead you to accept a kind of egalitarian love of all human beings just because they're human. And even somebody like Dawkins admits that and says, well, we have to transcend our natural morality. But what would you transcend it in pursuit of? I mean, religion can give an answer to that question, but he can't.
Say, if you please, a lesser of two questions, the first being a comment. You just might want to give a few words in response to it. And I'm not suggesting you have done this yet at all in this show, but there is a danger in making utilitarian arguments for Christianity or
uh-huh.
for creationism per se, just as it's very deadly to true Christian faith, just as is morality or moralism, that is, per
mm-hmm.
se. I'm sure you'll agree.
Okay, Roger, we've got other people on the line. Did you have a question?
Yeah, and lastly, what do you make of this goofy business about 6-8 years ago when the Roman Catholic Church carved out this a niche of acceptability for millions of years evolutionism? And do you think maybe perhaps at first glance it might suggest that they don't want to be caught like they did with Galileo?
Okay, fine. Thanks very much. And let's go ahead. And do you have any thoughts to tell about that? Apparently some people in key positions in the church had said that maybe evolution did take place, or at least the Earth had been around a lot longer than the 6,000 years many evangelical
uh-huh.
Christians think.
Yeah, well, I think that, with regard to the first point, the caller makes a good point, which is the point that C.S. Lewis made too, right, which that the ultimate argument for Christianity is that it's true, not that it's socially useful. So we want to beware of making a too utilitarian case, although the utilitarian case might have some place, too, because it would also be true that it is socially healthy. But, yeah, I think with regard to the other issue, I thought I don't know that the Catholic Church has any clear dogma on this, or I doubt that they do, but the Pope made some remarks about the acceptability of believing in some kind of evolution. It seemed to me that what he said was defensible insofar as he said, the body may have evolved, but there is a kind of ontological leap that takes place when a human being appears that cannot be explained by purely materialistic processes. So I think he was, conceding, the reasonableness of whatever it looks like evolution can explain, but still kind of reminding people that it will never explain the uniqueness of humanity as we see it.
Well, because one of the things about the Darwinian concept is this idea of the evolution of mankind. And then, of course, we can look around the world and we could say, well, maybe certain groups have evolved further than others. Other groups are really rather primitive, in their beliefs, their lifestyle, and their appearance. And I would think that, of course, Darwinianism is basically racist in its very nature. And in fact, I think this has been used to justify a lot of racial discrimination in our society.
Well, if it's not racist, and I'm not sure that it is, at least it kind of disarms itself against racism. From one other standpoint, I mean, Darwinians, especially those in the late 19th century, sometimes would speak about progress and development and evolution as, generating higher life forms. But if you look at Darwin himself and the more thoroughgoing Darwinians, they openly admit that no life form is any better than any other. And so that means that that's even more radical in a way, because it suggests that human beings are not any more worthy or dignified than any other animal. And that kind of, in a way, takes away, the kind of pseudo-scientific basis for Nazism. But at the same time, it leaves you kind of defenseless against racism from another angle, because it's already told us in advance that there's nothing special about humanity that deserves our respect.
Amen. Well, let's go to Ray, who's calling here. Hi, Ray. Do you have a question for our guest?
Yes, I do. Carson, now, I've been thinking, this Darwinism thing, is it being orchestrated from the very higher levels of our government? Because it's predominantly taught in public school, I wonder whether this whole thing is being orchestrated by people in our own government who are anti-God.
All right, but do you have any thoughts on Tal?
Well, I just have no knowledge or any, I don't know. Yeah. Well, I think it would be hard to do that, but...
I will tell you, Ray, that the great tax-exempt foundations are funding a lot of this, these efforts to destroy our belief in God. And I'm talking about the great Rockefeller, Carnegie, Ford. You go back 50 years, and they were doing everything they could. They were funding Kinsey to destroy sexual morality in our country and change our sexual laws. And believe me, there's tremendous amounts of money to go into this Darwinian movement today.
And of course, Planned Parenthood, too.
Right, of course. But they were funded by the Rockefeller Foundation as well. Go ahead.
I believe it. I think when you look at it, I think you can connect the dots, and you can go to certain people, influential people in science. I'm trying to think of a few examples. Bertrand Russell, Margaret Mead, for example, are people that were basically, pretty much openly anti-God, really.
Yeah, yeah.
They were scientists, too.
They pretended to be scientists.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, a science is a search for truth, and how anybody could go out, and look and see the marvels, of creation, and not realize there has to be creator. Why, of course, is beyond my concept, other than the intense hatred of God. Anything else, Ray?
Oh, that's all.
Okay, let's go to Mike, who's calling then from Santa Cruz. Hi, Mike. Did you have a question for our guest?
Is it fair to say that if we're taught that we're made in the image of God, then we're going to live like we're made in the image of God, versus if we're taught that we're descended from animals, then we're going to live like animals?
What do you think that's about, Carson?
Yeah, there is a kind of way in which, obviously there are dangers that go with religion. We see that from 9/11 and stuff like that. But ultimately, there's nothing in Darwinism to make us think that there's anything particularly dignified about ourselves. Nothing that really can sustain our self-respect, I think, in the way that religion can.
Yeah.
So, there's a lot of complex argument behind that statement. But I'm inclined to agree with it.
Yeah. Well, it goes a little further. We can say that animals have their own morality, and they live by it.
Mm-hmm.
And humans tend to adopt those morals. A Satanist will describe himself as a very moral person if he's living according to his beliefs in Satanism. So this morality, this word morality gets kicked around and changed in a lot of ways that we really should be aware of.
Well, maybe we should refer to Christian morality then, okay?
Yeah, God's morality.
All right.
The word Christian goes a lot of strange places, too, these days.
I'll say it does.
Yeah.
Okay, fine. Have any comment on that, Carson, before we let our guest go?
No, I think that's a reasonable point. We need to know exactly what morality we're talking about. That's part of the argument of my book, in fact, is that there's a little bit of sleight of hand there, I think, on the part of the Darwinians. They say that their teaching can sustain morality in all of its glory and dignity, but it turns out that even the morality they're arguing for is really not a very demanding one. It's more just kind of a minimal sociability. And even that they can't really defend in the end either.
Okay, anything else, Mike?
Oh, good enough for now. Thanks a lot.
All right, thanks very much. And, of course, we have a real problem in our society today. We have a general moral breakdown at every level of society. And certainly it involves, I believe, all religious groups. And certainly, and then, of course, I believe a growing number of people who, because of what they've learned in school, have turn their back on God. And there's a really an organized effort, orchestrated effort, through the teaching of evolution, to destroy belief in God. Would you agree with that?
Well, it makes, yeah, there are a lot of powerful, culturally respectable people who try to argue that evolution somehow disproves the belief in God, and that's really not a very credible statement. It is dismaying to see the extent to which some people who have get popular attention will make that argument over and over again. At the same time, you can notice that a lot of actual, real, practicing scientists are themselves believers. So there's some hope that this argument won't take. At least I'm hopeful.
Well, I think that what we need to do is get people to sit back and look objectively at what's going on. And there's no way, of course, you can study biology and imagine this just happened by accident any more than you can study mathematics and think that the numbers just came out of nowhere in the perfect order, whether it be in mathematics or whether it be in music or whether it be in astronomy or the order in chemistry and the order in physics. I mean, there is a general order in literally everything in the world. And, of course, it didn't just happen by accident. We'll be back in just a moment to wrap up this evening's program here at Radio Liberty. Well, Carson, you've got 3 minutes to wrap up the program.
Is there anything else you'd like me to address from the book?
Well, Chris, you have a whole large list of questions here. I think we've covered most of them. What do you really hope to accomplish with this book? And of course, do you think it's going to have an impact in this dialogue that the Darwinists are trying, these so-called conservative Darwinists are trying to put forward, that we can somehow simply go ahead and accept what they're saying because they're pushing morality too? We're all headed the same direction, and I don't think we're headed the same direction at all. I think they're trying to mislead us and maybe trying to salve their consciences for the terrible harm they've done.
Well, you know, what I want to accomplish, I think, is to make the reader take seriously the Tocquevillian view, the view of Tocqueville that a decent democracy really requires religion. You know, that democracy has inclinations toward materialism and hedonism that only religion can hope to restrain. And I don't think that Darwinism can do that for us. So, Tocqueville's basic point is that if you're being a good religious person, you're also being a good citizen of a democracy. So I'd like to revitalize that sense, I think.
Well, I think it was William Penn who said, "Those who will not be ruled by God will be ruled by tyrants." And de Tocqueville has been quoted as saying, "You know, after coming to America, I sought for the key to the greatness and genius of America in her harbors, in her fertile fields, and in her boundless forests, in her rich mines, and the vast world commerce, in her public school system and the institutions of learning, and I sought for it in a Democratic Congress and her matchless Constitution. But not until I went into the churches of America and heard her pulpits flaming with righteousness did I understand the secret of her genius and power. America is great because America is good. And if America ever ceases to be good, America will cease to be great." And, attributed to Tocqueville. I don't know if he said it or not. Did you ever come across that in his writings?
I can't remember it, but I'll tell you what I do remember is that he says, "Religion is the first of America's political institutions because it teaches them how to use their freedom." Right? I mean, freedom requires a certain kind of discipline and morality, and his belief was that religion was essential to supporting that. And again, that's kind of the argument I'd like to press and get people to take seriously through the book.
And, of course, without religion, without morality, there can be no freedom. I believe the two are inseparable, and I think you'd probably agree with that.
I certainly would.
All right, God. Our guest has been Carson Holloway, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Nebraska. Always a pleasure talking to you. Thank you so very much for being our guest again this evening.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Good night. God bless. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and this was rather an academic discussion, but I think it's an important discussion to understand that there's some people within the Darwinian movement who are trying to confuse the issue and saying, "Oh, well, we believe in morality." But whose morality? I mean, if you don't look to God as the source of morality, then you're going to have to become your own God and determine what's moral. And look around us today and look in America today on the political scene, and look at our political candidates running for office, and how many of them are truly moral individuals? Well, certainly if you can't trust a person to be moral, can you trust them to be president? And anyway, under any circumstances, we have real problem in America today because of the influence of Darwinism and how it has been used in our schools to destroy the faith of our children. And they're not interested in hearing both sides. They are interested in one thing, and that is destroying the faith of our children. And that's what public education is all about today. It's not education, it's indoctrination in immorality, sex education, homosexuality, acceptance, you know, of these concepts that, of Darwinism, that there is no God, and that you make your own decisions. And this is what they teach our children today. You have to learn how to make decisions, intelligent decisions, moral decisions. And what 15-year-old can make moral decisions? Maybe if we spent a little more time teaching them about God and less about sex and sexual immorality and sexual perversion, we might have a better country. Well, under any circumstances, we do hope that many of you out there would certainly want to get some of the material that we have available at Radio Liberty, an understanding of how we got into the mess and why it was that the Supreme Court took God out of our schools. Everybody knows that the Supreme Court took God and prayer out of the schools, but none of our leaders will tell us why. Well, if you read the book Brotherhood of Darkness, I will tell you why they took God and prayer out of our schools. And, of course, you can get the book, you can get the DVD. They're available by calling 1-800-544-8927. It will lead you to an understanding that we're involved in a spiritual battle. If you've not yet certainly heard my talk on the Forbidden Secret, you need to get that. You need to get our 4-tape or 4-CD set on the secret, behind the secret. And then, of course, you need to get the information, the 4-tape or 4-CD set on the supernatural. Because there is a supernatural element to everything that's going on today. We have, of course, a book written by Tom Horn that we carry going into the Stargate, and we certainly advocate that, and the exact name escapes me now, but it goes in the Nephilim, the Stargate. And you have to understand that there is a battle for the souls of men and the survival of Christian civilization, and we're losing that battle because most people do not understand that the battle is even going on. We hope you want to get our 4-tape or 4-CD set on Satanism, Satanic Crimes is the title. And, of course, we have a book by the same title. It goes into the background of the Bilderbergers. If you'd like to know about the Bilderbergers, this powerful secret group that meets on a yearly basis somewhere in the world and picks our presidential candidates, as they picked Bill Clinton back in 1992, and why, of course, you certainly would want to get the 4-tape set or the DVD we have on the Bilderbergers. The DVD is called Endgame, put out by Alex Jones. The 4-tape set we put together from our interviews on the Bilderbergers, that's 4-tape or 4-CD set. We carry the book, The Bilderbergers. We carry the book, The Bilderberger Diary by James Tucker. So we have 2 books and a 4-tape set and a DVD. And then if you want to know about Satanism and the Bilderbergers, why, of course, the book is Satanic Crimes. And, of course, there's a 4-tape set or 4-CD set that comes with that. Understand really what's going on today, and without that understanding, you cannot be effective in this battle that is being waged to destroy America and to enslave the world. And, of course, we're moving rapidly into a financial crisis. We're moving towards war. I believe we're moving into a period of chaos and crisis. And, well, the only thing that's going to see us through is our faith. Please pray for America, pray for Radio Liberty, pray for our provision and our protection. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, and, well, this next hour they're going to be the views of Lee Penn. And Lee Penn is a fascinating young man. We've interviewed him before. He started out as a Marxist and then eventually converted to Christianity. And he's done a lot of great work on many, many subjects. But we're going to be talking with him tonight about the United Religions Initiative. And, of course, those of you who listen to our program regularly will notice that we believe that there's an organized, orchestrated effort to bring about a new world order, a new world religion, and a new world ruler. Now, we do a lot of shows on this effort to bring about the world government, and we talk about how the effort to create a North American Union is a stepping stone to the new world order, and we talk about these concepts that have been laid out for well over 100 years of bringing about the world government, and Cecil Rhodes' dream of this, and certainly H.G. Wells' book on the entitled The New World Order, written back in the 1930s, but most people really don't understand there's this second movement, equally as important as the New World Order, and that is the New World Religion. Well, of course, Lee Penn has written a fascinating treatise on that. It's called The False Dawn, but we're going to be talking this evening about this effort to utilize the United Religions Initiative, and it is a very active program to bring about that world religion. Lee, thank you so very much for being with us.
I'm happy to be with you tonight, Stan.
All right, fine. Well, let's get right to this very issue. But what is the United Religions Initiative, the URIP? What is it, the URI?
The URI, United Religions Initiative, is a global interfaith movement. It was founded in 1995. By Bishop William Swing, the Episcopal Bishop of California, and its stated goal is to be, as it calls itself, a growing global community dedicated to promoting enduring daily interfaith cooperation, ending religiously motivated violence, and creating cultures of peace, justice, and healing for the earth and all living beings.
That sounds really pretty great.
Oh, it's just the thing. If you figure that it is possible by any means to create a global culture of peace, justice, and healing, not just for people, but for all living beings and for the earth. So there's more than a bit of utopianism going on there. And the other flag that the URI's self-description in their own charter should raise is that they say themselves, URI in time aspires to have the visibility and stature of the United Nations.
I see. Well, does it work in concert with the United Nations, with this whole concept of this this concept, this Parliament of Religions that goes back to 1894?
Yes, it works both with the interfaith movement and with the United Nations. And let's take the UN, first of all. It was actually a call from a UN official in 1993 that supposedly inspired Bishop Swing to meet with other interfaith activists in 1993, 4, and 5, and to found the URI in the first place. And the URI has been a declared partner of the UN, especially UNESCO and the UN Environmental Project since 1999. And the UN has given increasing recognition to the URI. In 2001, the Department of Public Information accepted the URI as an official non-governmental organization. And just this last spring, May of 2007, the Economic and Social Council, or ECOSOC, gave the URI a higher level of recognition as a ECOSOC non-governmental organization. So they can now not just attend and watch UN meetings, they can also participate.
Hold that thought, we'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan, I guess, this is Lee Penn. And, of course, the interesting thing about this is most people really have never heard of the URI and this whole concept of this this United Religious Initiative. And people have to, though, really understand the politics of government. And you can go back thousands of years. And whenever you had a government, you usually had a religious component to it. And in the tribal areas in Africa, wherever you have a tribal chief, you have a witch doctor. In the tribes of Asia, you had the ruling chief or the ruler, and then you had a shaman. If the Egyptian pharaohs, they had their priests and their prophets, and certainly the children of Israel had their prophets, and certainly in Europe, where we had the Catholic Church, certainly authorizing the monarchy, the Holy Roman Empire, and of course many times the popes would crown the kings, and then the kings would verify the church. So what people do not understand is that religion and government go together. Now, I'm not saying this is good. I'm saying this is the way that it has always been, and of course the rulers always depended upon their priests or their advisor, religious advisor, being able to contact the other dimension, the supernatural, to give them power. And, of course, many of them did get their power through these supernatural entities. And how fitting it is today, as we move towards the world government under the United Nations, that we would see the URI working in concert with the United Nations. Would that be a fair statement?
Yes, it is. One of the things that historians, both from the left and from the right, have recognized, as you said, that stable civilizations depend on a religious basis. And even Toynbee, I think, said that almost every civilization save one, and the one exception was modern Western civilization, has been based on a culture that was an integral whole that included a specific religion. Modern secular Western civilization is the one exception out of 20-some-odd. And probably that exception is going to be coming to an end one way or another. And those who support the interfaith movement and those who support global governance understand, I think, this law of history, that if they want to create what Gorbachev calls a new civilization, then they need to have a new unifying religion that can bind the civilization together.
And even Gorbachev realizes the importance of having a spiritual component to the coming world government, which he supports. And what people don't understand is that Gorbachev is deeply involved in religion, only it's, of course, not the Christian religion, but rather the occult. Well, we'll be back here in just a moment with Lee Penn as we explore these ideas. What is the URI and why is it growing? Well, this is Dr. Stan. We were just pointing out that Gorbachev has certainly acknowledged the importance of spirituality as far as the coming world government. Now, remember, Gorbachev wants the world government. What most people do not understand is that Gorbachev is not an atheist. He is involved in spiritualism and the occult, occult religions, and those of you who haven't read one of the books we carry, of course, it's entitled Extraordinary Times, Extraordinary Beings, written by a man who's deeply involved with the occult. In fact, he claims that he's actually met Maitreya, and we carry the book here at Radio Liberty, and we think it's important you understand, because it goes into a great deal in Gorbachev. And Gorbachev is still one of the key players in what's going on in the world today. Now, what distinguishes the URI from other interfaith movements, Lee?
Several things. First of all, it has a more comprehensive program than any of the others. It has a wider range of adherents and supporters. It is not just looking at religious unity, but also aims at social reform and political unity. And it's growing very fast. Most other of the other interfaith movements have tended to be essentially salon movements of the liberal West. But the URI is growing rapidly worldwide, including in the global South, which, i.e. the Third World.
All right, who's putting up the money? Because that, of course, is the key. Follow the money. Who's putting up the money for it?
Some of the money is coming from the major liberal donors in the U.S. and Western Europe. When I spoke to a URI source in 2003, at that time, much of the money was coming from a few donors who were making grants of $100,000 plus. and that would include some private individuals and some foundations. And along the way, the URI has gathered some important donors. Bill Gates gave $1 million to the Global AIDS Interfaith Alliance, which is a URI cooperation circle that has since spun off and become its own international movement. The Templeton Foundation has given money. Certain Muslim lobbies in recent years have given money. The Council on American Islamic Relations and United Muslims of America, Bank of America, World Vision. So it's a very mainstream thing to do, to give money to the URI.
All right, fine. And certainly when we find Bill Gates there, we certainly want to be a little suspicious, because Bill Gates is funding the population control movement and the effort to vaccinate all those little black children all throughout the world with vaccines laden with mercury. And you have to ask yourself, why would he want to give those vaccines laden with mercury that lead to all sorts of physical disability and, of course, to infertility to those little black children? In fact, we find so much of what Bill Gates does is counterproductive to the best interests of the people he's supposedly trying to help. But then when you believe in population control, maybe this explains some of what's going on. Well, is the URI part of the mainstream interfaith movement?
Yes. To loop back for a second, the interfaith movement got its start in 1893 with the Parliament of World Religions in Chicago. And it was at that event that that Hindu and Buddhist missionaries first began appearing in the West and began making religious syncretism and Westerners converting to Eastern religions. It was at that event that this phenomenon really became above ground. And the Theosophists were then, as they are now, very much involved in and supportive of the interfaith movement. And since then, the interfaith movement has proliferated. There's a whole range of interfaith organizations, the Temple of Understanding, the World Conference on Religious and Peace. The Parliament of World Religions is still going, and they now have gatherings every 5 years. The last one was in Barcelona in 2004. And the URI is working hand in glove with all of these groups. You might think that there would be competition between the groups, but ultimately when the tips are down, I'm sure they're going to be cooperating.
And of course, you certainly would wonder why anybody would want to be working with a Theosophist, because, of course, they are a totally occult and depraved organization. Anybody who's read the writings of Helena Petrovna Blavatsky, who created this religious faith, knows, of course, that she thought that Satan was the real God. Why would any Christian organizations be wanting to be affiliating with an organization such as the Theosophist?
That's a very good question. And we have to remember that the Lucis World Lucis Trust and their World Service Fund gave money to the URI earlier on in its career, back in 2002.
Well, could you tell our listeners a little bit about the Lucis Trust, those who are unacquainted with the term Lucis Trust? It almost sounds like Lucifer, doesn't it?
The Lucis Trust actually began its life in 1922 as Lucifer Press, and they renamed themselves within a year or two. Although if you look on the net, you can find early edition of Alice Bailey's books that bear the imprint of Lucifer Press. And they took the name of Lucifer Press from Helena Blavatsky's Lucifer magazine, which was current in the 1880s and 1890s.
I think what most people don't understand is this is a resurgence of Gnosticism that's believed that there are two gods. I mean, there's a god that the Christians worship, who is not really much of a god at all. And then, of course, there's the real God that will give you power and freedom, and that's Lucifer. And when you talk to people about that, they look at you as if you've got to be crazy. And yet there are millions of people who embrace this philosophy throughout the world today.
Yeah, it's essentially they believe that Lucifer was the great angel that liberated mankind from being an automatic obedience to God, and that he was the one who brought enlightenment, wisdom, and freedom to mankind. So they've taken the actual story of the fall and inverted it. You might call it the ultimate transvaluation of values.
In fact, if anybody would like to, they go to my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, where we simply quoted from Albert Pike's book, Morals and Dogma, where he tells you, of course, that in the Garden of Eden, Why, of course, it was the demon who told Adam and Eve not to eat of the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, but it was the angel of light that told them to go ahead and eat of that fruit and then, of course, be set free. And you read that, the demon told them not to eat the... And you have to understand, everything is an inversion of truth, when modern-day masonry is simply a manifestation of the ancient heretical belief of Gnosticism. And that seems to be so prevalent in this URI movement. Now, does President Bush support the URI movement?
Yes, explicitly and implicitly. In terms of giving explicit support, in November 2001, he sent a letter of congratulations to Bishop Swing and to the URI, and he was praising them for winning the International Diplomacy Award from the International Diplomacy Council, which is an organization in San Francisco that works closely with upper-level State Department officials and helps overseas VIPs have a comfortable tour through the United States when they visit. And former Secretary of State George Shultz, who's also very much involved in the State of the World Forum, is part of the International Diplomacy Council, as is Shirley Temple, a Republican star from long ago.
Now, I think for our listeners out there, the State of the World Forum is Gorbachev's State of the World Forum. And, of course, when he calls a meeting, all the leaders of the world come. In fact, he had the membership list of who attended his 1995 meeting, if any of you would like it. And then again in 2000, he called a meeting of the State of the World Forum, which was held right along in parallel with the Millennium Summit and the meeting of the Parliaments of the World, I guess it was Parliament of Religion, back in New York City there in the year 2000, the Millennium Conference. An amazing thing to see all of these coming together in one massive meeting there in New York City.
So Bush sent this letter of congratulations, and at the same time so did Governor Gray Davis, who was a Democrat who was later on recalled by the voters in 2003. So Bush and the Democrats were on the same page in terms of praising the URI. And more recently, in his 2005 inaugural speech, Bush talked about the house of faith being built in America that would include the values of the synagogue, the church, and the mosque. And in the fall of 2007, he gave an interview to a Arab radio station in Al Arabiya that said that he believed in a universal God and that everybody worships the same God.
How could that be? Certainly we do not worship the Allah, who is, of course, isn't a cult God. He's the sun god and the moon god, I guess it is. How could the president say we all worship the same God? Does he have any concept at all of the Christian faith, or the fact that God punished, the God of the Old Testament, the New Testament, punished people because they turned to other gods. And yet that seems to be what George Bush is advocating, is turning to other gods because we do not all worship the same God.
Right. I mean, it might be that, as the Catholic Church teaches with Vatican II, that the however many theological errors the Muslims commit, that Allah is the same God, but certainly you can't say that the worship of Kali and Shiva and the various Hindu gods, or the worship of the gods of the animists and the Wiccans, those are not the same God as the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. So it's rather silly to say that everybody worships the same God.
And yet, of course, the president, speaking as a Christian leader, has said we all worship the same God, and I think that maybe he needs a little tutelage about the Christian faith.
Yes, he does.
And I really, of course, is the URI say or do anything that traditional Christians could actually support? And we're going to be back here in just a moment or two with Lee Penn as we explore these ideas. Here's an organization of immense power and immense prestige that is remaking world religion, and yet most Americans have never heard of it. I wonder why. Or maybe it's because you're not supposed to hear about it. Well, Lee, is there anything that the URI is putting out that a Christian who really believes in the Bible and the divinity of Jesus Christ, is there anything that URI puts out that a Christian could actually support that would not be in conflict with the fundamental beliefs of Christianity?
Well, it is true that some of their chapters are involved in relief work for the poor, especially the chapters in the Third World. One of their chapters in Uganda is involved in attempting to negotiate an end to a civil war that's been going on there for 20-plus years. And some of their chapters are involved in such things as famine relief in certain drought-stricken third world countries. So some of the URI chapters do actually do what Christians would call the corporal works of mercy. But I think there are many ways to do the corporal works of mercy without being involved in or supporting an organization like the URI that is so heavily tainted with secular messianism, with utopianism, and with New Age.
All right, I certainly share your concerns about that. Now, who opposes the URI?
There's not very much public opposition to the URI. There's, there are traditional activists, people like yourself and myself. In the Anglican world, support to the URI vastly outnumbers any public opposition. Some 20 Anglican bishops and archbishops, including Bishop Swing and the former presiding bishop of the Episcopal Church here in the U.S., Frank Griswold, have been open supporters of the URI. So is Archbishop Desmond Tutu, the retired Nobel laureate bishop from South Africa. And against all these people, only two Anglican bishops have spoken publicly against the URI, and they're both retired.
Well, I think the most amazing thing is the Archbishop of Canterbury, who leads the Anglican Church in Great Britain, within the last week has come out and said that England should adopt Sharia law. Sharia law, that's the Muslim law. And yes, the Archbishop of Canterbury has come out and said publicly that England should adopt Sharia law, which would mean, of course, some of the fellows might like that because you could have four wives, but then that could be rather much a complication, especially with things as expensive as they are in Great Britain today. And, of course, people are stoned and have their heads cut off and their hands cut off and for stealing. And certainly a woman is stoned to death for adultery and men are castrated. And yet these are all part of Sharia law. Why would any religious leader like the Archbishop of Canterbury come up with such a ridiculous statement? Actually, many of the people, the Anglican leaders in England, are calling for his resignation.
Yes, but I've been checking the news, and unless the Queen or the authorities, people outside the church intervene, the General Synod of the Anglican Church in England is fine. They're not going to carry out a putsch to get rid of Rowan Williams. And so what we've got essentially is political correctness run amok. The way it's being addressed is that certain property disputes, inheritance disputes, marital and divorce matters ought to be handled in a way that is consistent with the tradition for each sub-community. And Williams is mentioning the need to make exceptions from the ruling law in England for Catholics who don't want to support same-sex unions or allow adoption of babies to gay couples. So he puts the need for that kind of religious exception in there with the need for a religious exception for Muslims.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan here, and of course we were just talking with Lee about what's happened over in Great Britain, where the Archbishop of Canterbury, the leader of the Anglican Church of Great Britain, has come forward and said that, of course, they should have Sharia law there allowed in Great Britain. And of course, Lee is pointing out that this was primarily for Muslims. If Muslims want to have Sharia law, they should be able to have Sharia law. We should be sensitive to their desires and beliefs. Well, I'll tell you, I like what they're doing over in Australia. And, of course, as the Prime Minister of Australia said some months ago, if you're a Muslim and you don't like our laws, why don't you go back and live in a country where they have Sharia law instead of trying to bring Sharia law into Australia? I wonder if anybody over in England has the courage to say that.
Quite a few have. Unfortunately, not the Prime Minister of England, but certainly many people both amongst the intelligentsia and in the rank-and-file populace of England are saying that kind of thing, and quite loudly, and with good reason, because even the notion that Muslims might accept certain parts of Sharia law, well, Sharia law is an integral whole. If you accept any part of it, you wind up accepting the whole thing. And there's a question of, well, if the husband accepts Sharia law, how much freedom of action do wives or children, the lesser members of Muslim families, have to say, no, we'd rather live under the British common law?
And, of course, the thing is that many of the Anglican priests over in Great Britain are calling for the resignation of the Archbishop of Canterbury. But, of course, he is just he is symptomatic of this whole idea that we should unite the religions of the world. But if we unite the religions of the world, what's going to happen to Christian morality? Nobody's suggesting, the Archbishop isn't suggesting, that the Muslim nations adopt Christian morality. And, of course, the Muslim nations will not even allow a cross or a Bible to be exhibited. And if you convert to Christianity, why, of course, they have the permission to kill you. And that is not murder at all. That's simply carrying out Sharia law, which the Archbishop of Canterbury fully supports. Now, what the role do the cultists and the occultists and the New Age movement play in this URI movement, which is so prevalent today, whose existence has been fairly well concealed from the American people?
Well, there are various occultists who have had a prominent role early on in forming the URI. Neil Donald Walsh, who's written a whole series of books called Conversations with God, he's the one who said Hitler went to heaven, among other things, because there's no place else for him to go. Walsh was part of the committee that helped design the URI charter in 1997-98. Another New Ager who was involved in the URI in that same time period, Barbara Marx Hubbard, the URI calls her a futurist, and she's deeply into occultism and is a supporter of Alice Bailey. She was involved in designing the charter as well. Robert Mueller, the former Assistant Secretary General of the UN, who has been a fellow traveler both with Share International and with the Lucis Trust for decades, he gave one of the first public endorsements of the URI in 1995, immediately after Bishop Swing founded it, and he's continued to praise the URI and said that it should be adopted as a formal UN department as soon as possible.
And, of course, I think that people have to understand there's tremendous power behind this organization. Some of the richest people in the world are supporting it financially, including Bill Gates, which has funded its one of its front organizations, World Goodwill. And, of course, Bill Gates supports the Lucis Trust, but he also supports the URI, doesn't he?
Yes, he gave money to a URI cooperation circle several years ago, the Global AIDS Interfaith Alliance, which has since spun off and become its own movement.
All right, fine. And so people have to understand that this is a very viable organization, and its goal is to create a one-world religion, united religious initiative, and, of course, going along with the move towards the one-world government, the new world religion. And then, of course, the coming world leader. This is what it's really all about, ladies and gentlemen. And unless you understand that, you can't understand anything going on today. You can't understand why so often the United States funds both sides in every war, why we fight no-win wars, why we're fighting a no-win war in Iraq and in Afghanistan today. And, of course, why we send our boys overseas to fight and bleed and suffer and die, but we never allow them to win. And that's exactly what happens in Vietnam. That's what happened in Korea. That's what we did to the Cubans that we sent into the Bay of Pigs. We sent them in there to fight, but never to be allowed to win. And when you understand that so much, that makes sense. We're moving towards a one-world government, a one-world religion, and a one-world leader. We're going to be back in just a moment here with Lee Penn as we explore Gorbachev and what Gorbachev, the part that Gorbachev is playing in this. Gorbachev, the former dictator of the Soviet Union. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and of course, most people don't understand how powerful Gorbachev is today. But of course, when Gorbachev calls the State of the World Forum meeting, and of course, people from all over the world come, the leaders of the world. In fact, and we have, if any of you would like, and would be glad to provide it for you, the membership list of the people who attended the State of the World Forum in 1995. And there, of course, was President George Herbert Walker Bush, George Shultz was there, James Baker III was there, Mabiki, who would later become the ruler of South Africa, was there. World leaders from all over the world come when Gorbachev beckons them. Why does Gorbachev still have so much power? I mean, after all, he's deposed as far as the ruler of Russia, but why does he have so much power today, Lee?
Well, he's not formally involved in Russian politics any longer, but he has close friendships with various Western movers and shakers, some people with much more money than common sense. And there are these hidden interests that would like to have national sovereignty go away. They'd like to have the traditional religions go away so that there could be a, quote, progressive, unquote, one world government and a one world ecological religion. And the whole idea, of course, is to get the old elites out of the way so that this new elite can take power and remake the world according to their own designs.
And I really think that is so vitally important for people to understand that there really are forces at work behind the scenes that most people are totally unaware of. And of course, there is a move to transform the world in which we live. And of course, many of these people who want to transform our world, want to change the world in which we live, are affiliated with Mikhail Gorbachev, who, you know, can still command a fantastic amount of money. Sometimes he'll give a speech and get up to $100,000. And what could Gorbachev have to say that's really worth $100,000? And I would like to suggest it's simply a means of financing this very wicked man who actually presided over the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan and the brutality against the Afghan people. I believe he's a war criminal, and certainly he should be tried as such, but I can assure you that will never happen. Because Mikhail Gorbachev has very powerful friends in key positions in government. Friends like, well, of course, he was a good friend of Ronald Reagan, but he was a very good friend of President George Herbert Walker Bush, who dutifully attended the 1995 State of the World Forum. A call by Gorbachev. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan, our guest this evening, Lee Penn. We're talking about the United Religious Initiative. And Lee, before we go on, do you have a website or do you have anything that you'd like to tell our listeners about?
Sure. I've got two websites. First of all, book that I wrote about the United Religions Initiative, the Gorbachev Foundation, the State of the World Forum, and related movements is called FalseDawn.us. So that's www.falsedawn.us. And people can go online there and read excerpts from my book and can order the book directly from the publisher by a link from that site. They can also order the book through Amazon, and I've got to admit that Amazon gives free shipping, so there's a good deal. If they search for Lee Penn on Amazon, you'll find my book. The second thing is that I have another website called leepenn.org, www.leepenn.org. Part of the website covers False Dawn, and part of it is a collection of some other articles I've written about the New Age movement, the movements toward war and totalitarianism, and other cultural and spiritual topics that are relevant to the times.
And I will tell you that Lee is an excellent source of information. I recommend his material. He writes for the Spiritual Counterfeit Project, and he appears on programs such as ours and other programs trying to reach the American people to understand not only what's happening politically, but what's happening spiritually. And unless you understand the spiritual component of this, you can't understand anything that's happening politically, in my estimation. Now, what is the role of Gorbachev in this United Religious Initiative movement?
He's not directly affiliated with the URI, But his State of the World Forum co-sponsored the first URI Global Summit meeting in 1996. And there are quite a few people who attend both URI and State of the World Forum meetings. And there are foundations that give money to both. And there are some of the URI officials also have attended State of the World Forum meetings. As one of my URI sources said, it's not a conspiracy, it's a worldview, and that both the URI and the State of the World Forum promote what this source called the Western liberal worldview.
Now, how is your observation linked to the risk that the United Nations faces today that one day we could be attacked with weapons of mass destruction, in other words, nuclear weapons? What part would Gorbachev play in creating a situation where America would still be susceptible to a nuclear attack?
He certainly continued building up the Soviet arsenal during the late 1980s, and one thing that is little known is that as soon as he took power in 1985, Gorbachev aggressively built up the Soviet arsenal of germ warfare weapons, so that the Soviets developed tons of plague, brucellosis, tularemia, anthrax, and smallpox bombs, and put those on rockets, so that if an all-out war broke out between the U.S. and the Soviet Union, the intent was to aim these smallpox-loaded rockets at New York, Los Angeles, Chicago, and Seattle. And it's a really good question. If they made tons of these germs, where did they all go? Where did their scientists go? And germ warfare and the possibility of nuclear war are still part of the legacy of Gorbachev and Gorbachev's Soviet Union.
Amen to that. Well, now, what is the Earth Charter? What part did Gorbachev play in the Earth Charter? Why is the Earth Charter so very, very important today?
The Earth Charter is a proposed international treaty that would govern human behavior toward the environment. As such, it would ultimately be the basis of black letter law that would govern everything from City Hall to the United Nations. And it was Gorbachev, as the head of Green Cross International, and Maurice Strong, who's a wealthy proponent of world government from Canada and a former executive director of the United Nations Environmental Program, those were the two men who were behind getting the Earth Charter movement going. And the URI has endorsed the Earth Charter, and the URI worked very closely with the UN Environment Program, so they are implicitly part of the Earth Charter movement. And Gorbachev said that described the Earth Charter as a covenant similar to the United Nations Declarations on Human Rights. My hope is that the Charter will be a kind of Ten Commandments, a Sermon on the Mount that provides a guide for human behavior toward the environment in the next century and beyond.
And I think that's an amazing statement. Gorbachev, who certainly doesn't believe in the God of the Bible, wants the Earth Charter, which was written, actually, his collaboration and certainly that of Maurice Strong, but probably primarily written by Stephen Rockefeller, the son of Nelson Rockefeller, and the Rockefeller family has been deeply involved with the occult, you know, for many, many years, probably for well over a century. But certainly Gorbachev has referred to this Earth Charter as the new Ten Commandments for the world, a guide for all of humanity. And if you read it, it's all about spirituality. It's certainly about redistribution of the wealth within nations and between nations. And, of course, it was really a call for a world dictatorship. But with this new spirituality, which is entirely different than the traditional spirituality, and goes along with this idea of the one world government, the one world religion, the one world leader.
Yes, and the Earth Charter has lots of high-flown language, but Gorbachev in 1997 wrote a document called the Earth Charter Philosophy, which makes the Charter's meaning very clear. And I'll read you a few principles from this document. Principle 6, stabilization of the world's population. World population must stabilize. Principle 7, zero growth of material economy. And what they say there is that a basic sustainable level of per capita material consumption will have to be reached in accordance with the Earth's natural resource constraints. This requires increasing the material consumption of the people living in poverty and reducing material overconsumption by the rich minority.
I think that's such an important statement, because what they really intend to do is redistribute the wealth of the world.
Right.
Lowering the living standards in the United States. And this is exactly what's happening today. And it is being carried out by our Congress and our legislators, and of course doing away with our tariffs, transferring our industries overseas, transferring our wealth to other countries. We're still financing the Soviet Union today. We're pouring money into countries throughout the world today, while we're having to borrow over $2 billion a day just to meet our own expenses. What sort of madness is that? And the America has the greatest debt of any nation in the world today. The United States debt is over $9.3 trillion as of tonight. $9.3 trillion.
And have you heard the latest about the latest thing that the U.S. is financing?
Well, you mean the fact that we're financing the Soviet scientists who are actually providing the nuclear technology for Iran?
Yes, and of course, it's precisely the nuclear technology for Iran that would be our excuse to go to war with Iran.
But, of course, this is the way we always do, Lee. We always fund both sides of the war, whether it be the Iran-Iraqi war. We were funding both sides. Even during the Vietnam War, we were funding indirectly the North Vietnamese so they'd have a weapon so they could transfer to the Viet Cong to kill our boys. We were funding Russia. We were pouring all sorts of money and equipment and technology into Russia all during the Vietnam War when Russia was providing the weapons for North Vietnam. Why would we do something like that? Unless, of course, there's another agenda behind everything going on today.
And going back to the Gorbachev document on the meaning of the Earth Charter, there's one more point. Principle 14, global sovereignty. Let me read it straight to you from the document. The protection of the biosphere as a common interest of humanity must not be subservient to the rules of state sovereignty, demands of the free market, or individual rights. The idea of global sovereignty must be supported by a shift in values that recognize this common interest. And the implementation is to be by means of, quote, creation of an international body for the sustainability of human life on Earth. This body must have the independence and power to facilitate agreement between all social actors to support protection of the biosphere as a common interest of humanity. So there you have it. No states, no national sovereignty, no free market, no individual rights. The protection of the environment, as defined by these new totalitarians, would be the guide star for this new all-powerful international organization. That's their dream.
And of course, that has been the common goal of the cult organizations and secret societies for 3,000 years. And it's coming to fulfillment today. And we see within the New Age movement of today and these occult organizations the fulfillment of this ancient plan for the one world government, the one world religion, the one world leader. And people don't understand. All of these things are coming to pass this very day as we are watching them. I think we're living in probably one of the most exciting times in recorded history. What do you think?
Yeah, I think things are reaching a culmination. I'm not going to try to set a date, but we're certainly headed into a period that's going to be a very troublesome period. If we get off, if it's no worse than what happened to the world between the 1914 and 1945, we'll be bloody lucky. And it could be much worse.
Well, I fear that it's really going to be a great deal worse. I think that it's only a matter of time before we're manipulated into World War III. In fact, today we are arming Syria, selling them sophisticated weapons. We're giving sophisticated weapons to Saudi Arabia. Why would we be doing that when we know that Syria and Saudi Arabia will be attacking Israel with and using those weapons? Why are we funding Pakistan today? And, of course, why are we funding Egypt that's using their money to get the weapons that they're going to use against Israel? Why are we funding both the PLO and Israel, the Palestinian Liberation Organization and Israel? Both countries, of course, are effectively at war with one another. But then, if you go back through history, you'll find out often we've funded both sides. In fact, Ron Paul gave a speech back in 1984 where he talked about how on two separate occasions the United States had actually rescued the PLO from being destroyed by the Israelis. And then, of course, once we got them rescued and rearmed, that they could go back to war with the Israelis. And yet Israel is supposedly our ally, and we're supposedly standing behind Israel. And so much of what's going on in the world today doesn't make sense unless you understand that, of course, it is all contrived, it's all play-acting, but it's all leading us, I believe, closer and closer to that nuclear Armageddon, which I feel is not too far away.
Yeah, if I had to give you a guess, I would say that we are headed toward nuclear war, and that it might, they're going to be, you know, there are any number of hot spots in the world today that could flare up into war. Certainly, the an attack on Iran could lead directly to war because Russia and China are allied with Iran.
Yeah, but, because, but we're building up both Russia and China. We're funding Russia. We funded them. And, of course, this latest expose of the, you know, funding the Soviet scientists who were providing the nuclear technology for Iran, that has just come out this last week or so.
Right.
But we've always found a means to funnel money into Russia. Even we have to borrow money to pay our debts. And Russia has the largest, I think, third or fourth largest reserves in the world today, with over $440 billion in reserves. And we have no money in reserves. We're borrowing money to pay our debts. We're the biggest debtor nation in the world today. Why would we be funding Russia when we have to borrow money to pay our debts? Nothing really makes any logical sense, Lee.
This is true. And part of what the plan could be is that if the U.S. and Russia devastate each other in a nuclear war, or if a war arises out of a conflict between Israel and the Arabs, or between the Western powers and an Islamic power, those circumstances will discredit nationalism, they'll discredit the monotheistic religions, and that would leave a great spiritual and material vacuum into which those who wish to create a new world order that's not based on any of the Abrahamic faith and is completely opposed to national sovereignty, that would be the vacuum into which they would rush. They would rebuild a shattered world and try to make things new.
And of course, what the average American really doesn't realize is that we have been unilaterally disarming. Remember the MX missile we had? Of course, they were put in under the Reagan administration. They were certainly very, very powerful. We had several hundred of those MX missiles. They've all been deactivated. They've taken many of the nuclear weapons off of our missiles, off of our nuclear submarines. We are unilaterally disarming while Russia and China are in full production for military war. And we have to ask yourself, why would any logical person be doing that? And why would George Bush have simply deactivated our MX missiles? People don't understand. Our army is in disarray. Our army is, it'll take at least a decade to try to get it back into some sort of effective fighting force. This is what our military leaders are trying to tell the American people. And, of course, as far as our strategic force, oh, we've got all these weapons. Russia has thousands of nuclear warheads, all aimed at the United States, and we have an anti-ballistic missile system up in Alaska with 6 interceptor vehicles on it. How are 6 interceptors, we're not even sure will work, will be able to bring down thousands of nuclear warheads that are aimed at America? None of this makes sense, Lee, and you try to tell people this, their eyes glaze over it. It couldn't be true, and yet it really is.
Yeah, the New World Order can't come about unless America is gotten out of the way.
Right.
And that's pretty much the plan that's afoot.
And it's so hard for people to believe that people at the highest levels of our government could be going along with this and is setting America up for a nuclear war that we would certainly not be able to win. And that is the frightening thing about what's going on today. And the American people do not understand. We are transferring our most sensitive military technology to communist China. We've already transferred our nuclear technology and MIRV missile technology to communist Russia. And, of course, today we're actually, in fact, Sybil Edmonds' story is really what's so amazing. That's our latest newsletter. Sybil Edmonds, of course, had found out that there was a clique in the State Department that was transferring our nuclear technology intensely to Pakistan. Everybody think that they got it by accident. No, it was given to them by people at the highest levels of our government. And the reason that they put a secrecy gag order on civil admins, we can't let the American people know that our government has been transferring nuclear technology intensely to the Muslim countries, I believe, in preparation for the coming war. That's our January newsletter. You'll certainly want to get it on the civil admins story. Well, Lee, we're just about out of time. What thought would you like to leave with our listeners?
I think that the crisis is deep, and I don't see any political answer for it. Certainly, the candidates who might offer a real alternative are not going to be nominated by either of the major parties. The first step has to be prayer, that prayer for God to guide our leaders and the world's leaders in doing God's will, prayers of repentance for any part of our own in fostering or collaborating with the great deception that's been going on, prayer as well as Jesus directed for our enemies. And it may be that with sufficient prayer and repentance that some of these trends might turn around
or at least be
mitigated.
All right, Lee, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but we've got 3 minutes before before we have to end the program. So you go right ahead with what you were saying. You were talking about the importance of prayer. And really, of course, today with an impossible situation, with no political leadership out there, what possibly can be done? And, of course, I think the one thing that people have to understand is this is a spiritual battle. It is not a political battle. It's being fought on a political battlefield, but it's a political battle. And, of course, it's not a cultural battle. It's a spiritual battle being fought on a cultural, on an ideological battlefield. And I think Lee's concept that we need prayer and we need repentance. I believe, Lee, we need a great revival in America. I just wish I saw some leaders out there who would be leading that revival.
Right. There may be none of the princes who will come forward, but even the divine liturgy in the churches I attend say, put not your trust in rulers, in princes of men. We have to trust God and pray to him for mercy and pray for our enemies. Pray for the whole world and for him and for his mercy to go wherever it needs to mitigate things. That's our best hope.
Well, I don't think the Chinese people or the Russian people are our enemies. I think it's the people who are in positions of power in those countries that are the enemies of freedom. And I think that many times they work very, very closely and in concert with the leaders here in the United States. But we can't let the American people know that. We can't let them understand that so many of the wars are contrived and really they're fought and to be no-win wars. Millions of people die, but we never tried to win in Vietnam. We did not try to win in Korea. We did not allow the Cubans that we sent into the Bay of Pigs to try to win that war, and we're certainly not allowing our boys to win the war in Iraq today. And if you doubt that, you need to read the speech given by Lieutenant General Ricardo Sanchez, who led the coalition forces in Iraq from June of 2003 to June of 2004, and in his speech of October 12th last year, which incidentally is our December newsletter, which you can get off our website at RadioLiberty.com, Ricardo Sanchez makes it very clear we haven't been allowed to win the war in Iraq. Well, Lee, I want to thank you so very much for being with us. It's been a real pleasure, and I look forward to getting you back on some of our other programs. Again, your website is
www.falsedawn.us, falsedawn.us, and also leepenn.org, leepenn.org. Follow the links.
And I think that Lee Penn is one of the greatest sources of information we have today. He's researched this unifying of a religious initiative. We need to get the information out. God bless. Thanks so much, Lee.
Thank you very much.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and I hope you enjoyed our conversation with Lee Penn, and we recommend his website. That's leepenn.org. It's leepenn.org, and I think you'll be fascinated by the material. Just Google in his name and his material on the False Dawn and, of course, this alternative religious organization to bring about the new world religion, which will supplement and certainly vindicate or the idea of the New World Leader, and they're all working together for this destruction of Christian civilization. When you understand that, everything going on makes sense, and you can only understand this by understanding there's an occult movement out there. Gorbachev is part of it, and many of our political leaders and many of our wealthiest people are part of this. And you only, of course, need to look in to find out who is funding so much of what's going on today, so much of the occult movement going on today, to understand what's going on. We have three little pamphlets called The Occult Hierarchy. We recommend this to you. They're taken from our newsletters, which you can read at RadioLiberty.com. But a convenient way to get the information at your fingertips and have it there for reference is the three pamphlets set. The occult hierarchy. And then, of course, we have a DVD with Constance Cumby talking about the emergence. And, of course, this is about the coming world leader. And then we have a four-tape set or four-CD set with Constance Cumby entitled "These." Well, just ask for the four-tape set by Constance Cumby. And, of course, it basically goes into this New Age movement and how they intend to bring about this one world government. And then, of course, if you haven't read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, or seen the CD, the Brotherhood of Darkness, you need to get it. To put things into their proper perspective, you need, of course, to get the DVD on the Forbidden Secret. Why is that important? Because it will explain the secret that has been passed down through the ages for 5,000 years. What is the secret? It's the secret to wealth and success and power that has been utilized by the great philosophers, by Plato and Aristotle and Alexander the Great. And did you ever wonder how Alexander, with an army of 35,000 Macedonians, could challenge the army of Darius the Great with a million men and elephants, and how he was able to win? Why, it tapped into the secret. And you can learn the secret, at least understand what it is. But let me warn you, you do not want to use the secret. You need to know it's there. And, of course, that is the story of my talk on the Forbidden Secret. We also have a four-tape set or four-CD set referring to Rhonda Byrne's message. And she reveals the secret as well in her book and DVD, which is featured on Oprah Winfrey and twice, actually, and on Larry King and by many other people. Jack Canfield at Chicken Soup for the Soul has endorsed this, the secret to wealth and fortune. But, of course, once again, we warn you not to utilize that secret, but to know it's there, to understand the spiritual nature of the battle that's going on. And that, of course, is the four-tape or four-CD set, The Secret Behind the Secret. We recommend, of course, the four-tape or CD set, The Supernatural, and the book that goes with that, The Beautiful Side of Evil. We recommend the four tape set. It goes into the background of the writings of Malachi Martin. Father Malachi Martin was a Jesuit priest, and of course, Father Martin was a confidant of Pope John Paul XXIII. And his four tape set, The Wisdom of Malachi Martin, and then the book that goes with that, entitled Hostage to the Devil. Hostage to the Devil. I read this book back in 1980, and it was one of those books that began to transform my life and maybe it helped me to understand what's really going on out there. Remember our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. If you'd like to call and ask for the suggested price on any of these, suggested gift on any of these. And then we ask you, of course, to pray for America, to pray for revival, to pray for our leaders and ministers, but please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. And so until tomorrow at the same time, may the Lord be with you.